to call these sacred proceedings to order, so I guess. All right. Well, good morning. Thank you. Well, thank you. You weren't doing it on my behalf, but it's great to see you, and I think you're to be commended for making it out on a Saturday morning. And so I just went ahead and went ahead. Is that all right, David? I don't know if you were going to have any announcements or thank you. All right, well, we're going to just draw it to a close and then try to come to some sort of a conclusion. But we are working our way through, and this is on your notes, and I didn't include a lot of specific notes, but just sort of the headings. But we're on page 6 of the notes. And again, let me just rehearse. I think you're probably familiar with it. I hope it's a thought experiment that works for you. But the intent is to ponder the concept of progressive revelation rather in terms of personal application. So we got to go back and get our arms around the distinctive way in which God was dealing in the Old Testament through Israel. And we try and make the case that God's activity in human history is certainly ultimately about His own glory, but that glory has to be put on display, or it's not glory, it's majesty, but it's not glory. And that He has done that, in every possible way. You got up this morning and looked out your window, and there was the sun coming up. That's God putting His glory on display. So I don't mean to say that this is exclusive, but it seems to me that the grand strategy in the Scriptures by which He determined to glorify Himself and to prove His nature and specifically His covenant-keeping nature, by the way, in that regard, the name by which God identifies Himself most descriptively is, in fact, Yahweh, right? How much do you know about the name Yahweh? I'm sure you've been through it many times, but it maybe would be good just by way of early morning devotion to ponder, to rehearse and ponder that real quickly. Have you ever heard, somebody said it's kind of like being in a college classroom. I hope that's not hard on anybody, but I kind of work at that. But have you ever heard of the JEDP theory? How's that for an early morning devotion for a thing? No, the JEDP theory is a set of demonic lies, but it is a theory developed in the 1700s, actually, to begin with, and then the 1800s, which claims that Moses didn't write the Pentateuch, but that the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, is in fact a compilation by some very late scribe, maybe about 400 years before Christ, of a number of strands of tradition, and they were competing strands. And the modern scholarship is so clever that they were able to figure out the key to unlock those strands and piece them all out. I shouldn't have got started on this. But at any rate, so they would claim that there was the four strands, and they identified them as, first of all, J, which stands for Jehovah, because one of the strands liked to talk about the God that they had decided to worship as Jehovah. And another strand was E, that's Elohim, because they used the word Elohim. So when you come across a narrative that has the word Jehovah or Yahweh, well, that's the Yahwist. And when you come across, and then there was a priestly writer and a Deuteronomist. I don't want to go any further with it. But the whole notion arose out of a really bottomlessly, at least careless, and I would say more probably malicious reading of Exodus chapter 6. And in Exodus chapter 6, in connection with the burning bush incident, God says, and this is such a blessed verse, and now listen, you look on TV at some story of some documentary that's talking about the Old Testament or Old Testament history, or you read in so many books, and sometimes in even books by supposed evangelicals, and you'll have some hint that the Pentateuch, which claims to have been written by Moses, wasn't written until about 400 B.C. It wasn't composed about 400 B.C. And that's almost entirely a function of the JEDP hypothesis, which is stupid. I mean, stupid at every level. But when you are desperate for some way to deny the authority of this book and thus the authorship. Yes. But anyway, I wander. I shouldn't go here. But look, I already started. So verse 3, God says, and this is at the burning bush, and he says, I appeared, God spoke to Moses, said to him, I am Yahweh. Now, I know, but I'll just say it again, that most translations, and I think this is a very happy, strategy. In order to identify specifically that very special name of God, which is Yahweh, they'll use those uppercase levels. So that's just a way to say that there are several words that could be translated Lord, but this is Yahweh. And he says, I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham and to Isaac and Jacob as Elohim, God Almighty, but by my name Lord, I was not known to them. All right, now listen, folks. I got way down this cul-de-sac. But this was misread, and some unbeliever, his name was Julius Wellhausen, the guy who really popularized this, but he read this and he said, wait a minute, the name Yahweh appears in Genesis 1. And yes, in Exodus it says, you never knew this name before. So there must be different strands of tradition. That's the whole argument. And so now he set out to supposedly tease out these different strands of tradition. You know what I mean? This whole, look. The critical, unbelieving, anti-supernaturalist. That's what's at stake. The unbeliever, the destructive critic of the Bible starts out by presuppositionally rejecting the possibility of the supernatural. And so if God exists, he stays home. He doesn't come down here. So now you got this book full of miracles and fulfilled prophecies, and what are we going to do with this? And so they'll insist that, in point of fact, these are all traditions, and somebody artfully wove them together to make it look like one story. And so now they untangle all those traditions. And this is Old Testament scholarship in the main. It really is. All right. But, I get this all out, and I forgot to plug it in again. All right. So, I have a point to make here. What are we going to do with this? In Exodus, 1400 years before Christ, we got God saying, by my name, Yahweh, you have not known me. And yet we got Yahweh in chapter 1, in the very beginning. All right, let's go back. Number one, remember that biblically, in the Old Testament, this word to know really almost always has a greater sense. It means not just cognizance, but relationship, understanding. It's a very emotive term, to be honest with you, and it speaks primarily of relationship. So what God is saying is, by my name Yahweh, you haven't understood the significance of that name. I have revealed myself as Yahweh, and yet hitherto, that is, up until the Exodus, you haven't understood. Mankind hasn't been given the event revelation, if you don't mind. I have not, God is saying, interacted in human history in such a way as to really help you understand what this name Yahweh means. But he's going to put that name on display through the Exodus. Does that make sense to you? All right, now let's talk about the name. I shouldn't have got so lost in the JEDP theory. But and let me say one other thing here. You know, this Julius Wellhausen was a bit of a mad genius for my money, because he sat with a pencil and paper and went through the Pentateuch, and he found all these little tiny supposed connections. He was a good authority in Hebrew, and he laid out all of this argument to show that the Yahwehs never used the word Elohim, and the Elohim, Elohim never used the name Yahweh, and the Deuteronomists, all this sort of stuff. And who's going to check his work, for heaven's sakes? You know, he's sitting there for years with a pencil and paper, but he's an authority. He's got a doctor, so he must be. So the whole world bought the JEDP theory. Well, then along came, what does the song say? I can't remember, Sam or whatever, you know what I'm saying? Along came computers. Guess what? We can check his work in a nanosecond. And everybody will acknowledge he was not only wrong, he was flat cooking the books. And so the whole set of data which supposedly proved the JEDP theory, or the documentary source theory, the traditional source theory, it's been totally blown to smithereens. But we still believe the JEDP theory. It's stunning. Well, it's not stunning if you understand who man is according to the scriptures. But, all right, I keep losing my way. So, I was sitting in the car this morning thinking, I can easily cover the material I got this morning, so I paint myself into a corner. No, listen, let's talk about it for a minute. Just it is such a blessedness. You're familiar with this. But what does the name Yahweh mean? Well, in point of fact, the name Yahweh is actually a Hebrew verb. It's the present the Hebrew verb to be, hayah. And Yahweh means it's a sentence. I am. That's what it means. Well, why would God refer to himself as the I am? Well, I think, let me show you another verse that I think speaks to this kind of interestingly, and that is Hebrews 6. Am I right? I hope I got the right verse. And verse 11. No, it's not. Hebrews, I wasn't going to talk about this. Hebrews 6. This is what the verb says, what the verse says. Somebody help me find it. Oh, my mind, I should know this. When God made promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no greater, he swore by his own name. I knew that verse. And the point is, look, the word it means I am. And in the Jewish world, 6:13, I was so close. Yeah. There it is. I have it in yellow. When God made a promise to Abraham because he could swear by no one greater, he swore, and I don't like the one there, to be honest with you, in the New King James. But the idea is, this is the issue. You know, when we want to make a, and this is more, not so much formally, but in our culture, if we want to swear, make some promise, we'll swear on the basis of something not only precious, but oftentimes unending. So you imagine, folks, you're sitting on the back porch years ago for some of us on, you know, with your affianced, and the moon is high, and she says, do you love me? And you say, oh, I love you. And she says, how long will you love me? Late next year won't work, right? And so the point being that come on, Johnny Mathis fan, till the lily loses its bloom or its perfume or whatever, you know, so the water runs uphill. Now, honest to goodness, this, by the way, this is what Jesus is beating up on the Jews for when he says, you swear by the gold of the temple, not by the temple. And so they would evidently, best we can tell, actually deliberately deserve, will you pay me back the 50 shekels? Oh, I swear by the gold of the temple. Aha, I didn't say by the temple, the gold might went away, but the two. And so, and that's when Jesus said, let your yea be yea, and so on. But the point is that they would swear on the basis of that which was perceived to be timeless. Now, the reference here is to Genesis, to God's promise to Abraham. And he says, because he could swear by no greater, he swore on the basis of his own name. Because here's the point. The name I am expresses his eternality, that it is nature to exist. If you had a, think about this, if you had a name, a descriptive name, which was the conceptual counterpart of Yahweh's name, I am, what would your name be? I mean, given the same issue, your name would be, I began to be. That's your nature. You're a creature. You were called into existence. So you could describe yourself as I began to be. God describes himself as I am. Now, you just blew a main fuse in the brain. There's no doubt about it. But there is that about God which we can't fully comprehend, but he makes it clear about himself. And one of the most important is that it is his nature to exist. He called all else into existence. So, the point is, when God made promise to Abraham, he promised, this is what Psalm 138 means, I think, when it says, I have placed my word above my name. The point being that I would rather pass out, God would sooner pass out of existence than break his word. But his very name reminds you he can't pass out of existence. It is his nature to exist. That makes sense to you? And that's why this name is so precious. Now, the Jewish world, at some fairly communal point, understood this. Because to this day, Jews don't say the name Yahweh. You're probably familiar with this. As a matter of fact, it's kind of familiar, and this is old heads to somebody, but it's kind of interesting to me how we don't know for sure how to pronounce that name. And you, many of you, grew up saying Jehovah. And the younger of you, every once in a while, that shows up in a hymn, and you're a little strange, you know, it seems a little strange. You know, what's this Jehovah? I thought it was Yahweh. Well, the fact is that it's called the Tetragrammaton. There are four Hebrew radicals or letters in the name. Most nouns have three, but this has four, and so it's sometimes called the four-letter word, the Tetragrammaton. But all we have is the consonants. It's called the radicals, YHWH. We don't have the vowels, because Hebrew is an unpointed language. So the point is that I don't know when, somewhere in early modernity, Bible was being translated into English and so on, and primarily because it's usually traced to the German language, they pronounced it Jehovah. Well, what we know for dead sure is that's wrong, because there is no J in Hebrew. They don't have the capacity to frame that, so they don't have a J in their language. But where you have, so Jacob becomes Yaakov, right? And Jerusalem becomes Jerusalem. So number one, Jehovah is wrong. And the J, we know that's not right. And so of late, and I lived through this, you kind of watched it, you know, the whole Christian world abandoned Jehovah and start saying Yahweh, which is fine. I don't know. There are good Hebrew scholars who say we're not much closer with Yahweh, but however you like it, now, what's that got to do with anything, though? Let's go back to Exodus chapter 6 and think about this. What God is saying is simply this, that by my name, Yahweh, you haven't known me. You haven't loved me for who I am as expressed in my name, Yahweh. But I'm going to teach you what I mean by that name. And the way he contrived, the way he had determined, and in fact did it, was to deliver Israel in explicit fulfillment of a promise he had made to Abraham 600 years before in Genesis 15. Your children, your descendants, are going to go, he says to Abraham, are going to go down to a land which is not there. They will be there 400 years. But after 400 years, I'm going to bring them out. And as I said before, it was absolutely unthinkable that the slave nation Israel could be delivered from the most powerful nation on the face of the earth, which nation was totally dependent upon their slave labor to maintain their status. And it was absolutely unthinkable. And yet God, through the series of plagues and so on, did in fact bring them out. And let me take that one step further. Because as you trace the story of the Exodus, and we love that story, as God interacts, Moses interacts with Pharaoh and so on, in the midst of the seventh plague, I believe it is, God says, makes a strange statement to Pharaoh through Moses, and basically, I'm not going to go there, but he basically says, listen, okay, this is Bookman's, I'm going to enlarge on God's word here just slightly, but what God is saying is, If all I wanted to do was get my people out of Egypt, I could have sent a plague. I could have wiped you all out, all you the Egyptians. We'd have walked out fine. But there's something bigger at stake. And that is, God says, I've determined to get glory on you and your soldiers. So he has this long series of plagues, somewhere 9 months or more. And remember, in each plague, Pharaoh gets harder and harder and harder. And how do you get hard, by the way? How does that happen? You say no to God. Every time you say no to God, you never walk away the same. There's a stealing, Paul calls it searing of the conscience and so on. And the net effect is, it's easier to say no. And pretty soon, remember now, keep saying, sin makes you stupid. And if there's any evidence of the fact that sin makes you stupid, it's Pharaoh saying no again and again. And because God is determined to get him glory on Pharaoh and his army. And I like to say, this is one of my favorite scenes in the scriptures, just to imagine it. You know, the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn, the Egyptians say, get out of here, and they force them out, and the glory cloud appears for the first time, and they set out. And the glory cloud leads them, I don't want to argue about exactly where it is, but leads them to a place where they are totally boxed in. They got the Red Sea in front of them, they got hills here, and they're boxed in, and here's the Red Sea, and Pharaoh hears about it, puts his armies together, the whole arm, and makes his way to recapture them. You can't overstate how important that slave labor was to everything Egypt was. And now, I love this scene, here comes, so you're one of the Israelites, and here's the glory cloud and so on, and I'm going to say again, you've been kind of dragged by the nose, but nonetheless, here it is, and you look back, and here's Pharaoh's army, and there comes, you know, this huge army coming to take you back, and punish you for it and so on. And all of a sudden, the glory cloud lifts up and positions itself between the Israelites, between the Jewish people and Pharaoh's army, and produces such a fog that Pharaoh's army can't see. They're bumping into each other. And that happens all night long. But in the meanwhile, the light of the glory cloud is providing light so that the Israelites can make their way across the Red Sea, right? And by the way, it's not single file, okay? So, you know, it had to be about a mile, probably, honest to goodness, because somebody has said that if they go single file, like in the movie, you know, that some of the people would have showed up in Egypt before some of them got across the Red Sea, you know. But the point is that, think about this, and I'm going somewhere with it. I like to say, here's Pharaoh. And, you know, he's all night long, he's been bumping into things because of the glory cloud. But now the glory cloud lifts, and Pharaoh looks, and he sees, number one, where the Red Sea ought to be, it's dry land. And maybe he sends God, down there is a wall of water. Up there is a wall of water. And maybe he watches the last Israelite scurry up yonder bank. And Pharaoh gives what is the most bottomlessly, unspeakably stupid command in the history of the world. Who does this? You got your whole army. I always say that was probably the most, you know, the charioteers or whoever, that was probably the most timid giddy-up you ever heard in your life. You know what I'm saying? Because, you know, you go out there and you're after the Israelites, and all of a sudden that water begins to rumble, and that water begins to rumble, and so on. And Pharaoh's entire army is destroyed. There's not going to be a human ear on earth that doesn't hear this story within a few months. This is the biggest story in human history to that point. That army... There was no close second to Egypt in terms of power in that day. Everybody in the world knew about Egypt and their might and their power. And they had been totally, totally destroyed in a moment by the God of Israel. I love to go to 1 Samuel 4. That's the passage where the Israelites take the ark into battle. And so you got the Philistines over here, and you got the Israelites over here. They're on yonder hills, on meeting hills. And the Philistine scouts come back and they say, you can't believe what they've done. They've brought the throne of their God into the battle. Nobody does this. And the Philistines begin to say to themselves, what are we going to do? This is the God who destroyed the Egyptians in the wilderness. That was 400 years later. And they're still now. Come way back. God says in Exodus 6, you haven't appreciated what the name Yahweh means, but I'm going to teach you. And what it means is that he is a God who keeps covenant, who has the character to be faithful to his covenant and the power to accomplish his covenant and the great display of it. And this is why the Jewish people are reluctant to even use the word Yahweh. You know that when they come to that word in the reading of the text, they say Adonai, which is another word for Lord. It's a lesser word. It's a perfectly noble word, but it's a word that also can be used for a human being. The name Yahweh is exclusively the God of the Bible. So, that makes sense to you. My point is that the name Yahweh is primarily descriptive or expressive is better of the fact that God is a God who keeps covenant. Now, let me take you way back to the notes and see if I can remember why I got going down that road, but that's all right. What I'm saying is that what we're doing here this weekend, and I appreciate so much you're working at it, but what we're doing is trying to see how God in Scripture has determined, what have I done? I did knock that over. God has contrived in so many different ways to demonstrate his this reality concerning himself. But tracing his activity as recorded in the Scripture, I think might be. Well, let me just go to number four here. All right, so let me make sure you understand what we're talking about, because we looked at the Old Testament and tried to lay out some ways in which, according to the narrative itself, he was working in ways distinctive to what he's doing today and ways related to the nation, the people, of the ethnos of Israel. Today, they have been set aside as the primary means by which God puts himself on display, and God has raised up the local church and that's our point. Well, so I've tried to identify six grand revelatory insights, that is, six specific, important, blessed areas of New Testament truth which were not available in the Old Testament. The idea of Trinitarianism, though there are hints of plurality, the very explicit reality that God exists in three persons, in eternal relationship, the means by which God can be both just and the justifier. The Old Testament saint didn't have that available to him. He could trust the promises of God, but didn't have that insight. And then this remarkable new covenant, which I would argue is yet to be ratified with Israel formally, but provision has been made for those blessings through the death of Christ, and believers, both Jewish and Gentile, enjoy those today. With a mind, it seems to me, Romans 11:11, of making Israel jealous both now and later. But let me take you to just the other three, and then we can be rather quick. The grand messianic question is two comings. Now, I mentioned this to you before. You remember I said that Isaiah 9:6, you have that verse, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, comma, the government shall be upon his shoulders. You have this again and again. We're living on that comma. This used to be talked about, some of us older folk, you can remember, I don't think I hear this too much anymore, but it used to be talked about as the mountain peak principle in prophecy, that you have these mountain peaks and you look into the future and you see, and they seem to be right on top of each other. In fact, there's a real valley you can't see. And whatever word picture or mental picture, the fact is, in the Old Testament, there is no clear revelation of two comings. And it was only very, well, look. I mentioned to you before that I have enjoyed, just over the last couple of years, it began to dawn on me. I began to ponder the life and the ministry of Jesus, and specifically the teaching of Jesus, with a specific focus, and that is to trace the care and the genius with which he introduced to his disciples the twofold reality that though he was Messiah, he got that nailed down, but though he was Messiah, nonetheless, he was going to leave without leaving a kingdom, which was totally unthinkable. When Messiah comes, he brings a kingdom. But by reason of rejection, he was going to depart. This is not God coming up with contingency plan B, okay? But nonetheless, for reasons that we talk about a little bit, God does not make clear in the Old Testament that doesn't really, only the slightest hint of two comings. But the reason for two comings is rejection. I'm going to say again, that is the whole, for my money, that's what Matthew is all about. Matthew is answering the question, if the Nazarene is Messiah, why no kingdom? And the answer is rejection, spelled out so carefully in that book. Now, and delicately. But at any rate, the point is this. I say the revelatory truth is that the long-awaited Messiah has come as foretold in the Scriptures, but was rejected. Therefore, he is yet to come and establish the kingdom. Now, as I say, Jesus works so carefully to introduce this and to persuade his disciples of it and so on. To us, it's second nature. I mean, not even second nature. It's a given. Jesus came. He's going to come again. Amen and amen. I just want you to take a moment and ponder that reality. I already talked about it, so we don't have to go back to it. Anything you want to mention, I'm happy to talk about it. But I think I can leave it other than to say this, that think about it in terms of the progress of Revelation. In the Old Testament, this was not understood. Well, there's one verse we ought to look at, and that is, I always get myself confused. I think it's 1 Peter 1. I teach this, but the prophets themselves pondered what or what manner of time. Am I in 1 Peter? The prophets. Here. I love this, by the way. Peter is talking about the blessedness of the salvation. This is a good progressive revelation, Pastor. Now, think about it. Peter is talking to his. Peter is writing to believers who have begun to suffer persecution and are confused about it. Because theirs is a legal religion in the Roman system. But because of Nero's madness, this persecution has begun and they're confused. And so Peter writes to give them hope. And that hope is based on an understanding of the reality and the assuredness of the salvation. And so he's talking about the blessed inheritance they have. But then he says this, of this salvation, the prophets have inquired and searched carefully. Now, all right, you just read that. It's but I want you to picture Isaiah and call him to mind, whatever Isaiah looks like in your mind. And he's sitting on a rock and he's got a little writing board and he's writing. And there are tear stains on the vellum because he's just written Isaiah 53. And he knows what it says. And his heart is broken. But now fast forward just a little bit, and he's sitting on the same rock, and God has just revealed to him, and he has written Isaiah 61. And he's just sat down after hopping around the yard for a while and swinging his arms in the air. Because he's so excited about what he just wrote, the rule and reign of Messiah. But now our prophet sits on that rock and gets a little contemplative. And I want you to see him scratching his head saying, how can this be? What's he thinking about? I can tell you. It's right here. As soon as I get that out of the way. It says, they searched carefully who prophesied of the grace that would come. And then he said to you, and then he says, searching what or what manner of time, the Spirit of Messiah. Now, don't read Jesus into that verse. Isaiah doesn't know who the Messiah is, but he knows that the Spirit of Messiah, that is the Holy Spirit, has been revealing them. And he's hungry for Messiah, and he's been writing about Messiah. But he says, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ who was in them was indicating when he testified beforehand, here it is, the sufferings of Messiah and the glory that should follow. Now that's a legitimate question. That's what it's saying. It's so legitimate that the prophets themselves who wrote the prophecies scratched their head and said, how can this be? That on the one hand, Messiah is going to reign. Now, you're going to suffer. On the other hand, and let me just say, I shouldn't go here, but This is one of the verses which is appealed to argue that the Old Testament doesn't make any sense until the New Testament comes along. And so we're told by those who want to say that the New Testament totally unsays the Old Testament, which it doesn't, that, well, this verse says that they didn't know what they were writing about. You see what's going on here? It was because they knew exactly what they were writing about that they were confused. They knew it meant the sufferings of Christ. They wouldn't have been confused if they didn't understand the passages, what they had written down. This verse says exactly the opposite. They knew exactly what they were writing. But how could they make sense of the fact that Messiah is going to both suffer and reign? And you and I have an insight that takes all the work out of that, and that is the doctrine of two comings. So even as we contemplate, the blueprint is so much more clearly laid out for us that we can understand. So I'll leave it at that. I go back to it. The revelatory truth is that Jesus, the Messiah, the Old Testament saint is yet to discover his name is Jesus, but the Messiah is going to come and be rejected, and of course, that's happened, and is yet to come. So, that makes sense to you? Folks, I said to you last night that I enjoyed Pete Gaiman's sermon some weeks ago, in which he drew such a tight biblical line between hope and patience and endurance, that the Spirit of God, it's a fruit of the Spirit, so it happens. But how does the Spirit minister that to you? And I said, it's through truth. And this truth of, Messiah has come, and we understand how those melancholy passages that prophesy, that foresee the suffering of Messiah, how that has come to pass. But now we can understand what's going on. All right, I'll leave it alone. All right, number five. Any question about that? Any comment? Again, I didn't take the time, but just it's fun to think about. But I want you to think about it specifically in this regard, that you know something Isaiah didn't know, and it's helpful. This is the progress of revelation. This is good stuff. All right, so let me go to another one. The grand expression of grace, and I talked about this before. The Gentiles are to be accepted as Gentiles. Now, again, because our minds are so kind of almost habituated to think that the Bible is only about what God is doing, is only about salvation, and because I think, frankly, even in the Bible-believing evangelical world, there is such a neglect of serious reading of the Old Testament. Folks, you cannot carefully and maturely understand what God is revealing in the New Testament if you don't saturate your mind and spirit with the Old Testament. All right? And that's not done today. I have a friend, well, he wouldn't call me his friend, but I won't tell you the story, but I just never forget. He had taken a really cheap shot at dispensationalism, and he was kind of a student of mine, and so I called him. I said, "Bob, next time I'm in town, I'm going to buy you lunch, and I want to challenge you about your spirit, because I mean, I don't care if you believe dispensationalism, but he would treat it with such contempt." I had a friend who was in his church, and he went to his new members class, and he said they were going to talk about eschatology, and so what this pastor did is he took a blackboard and he wrote, I don't know if it was a blackboard, but he wrote on a board, "Well, we don't care about this, about eschatology in this church. We don't think it's worth any time. But by the same token, there are four schools of thought. If you don't understand these, don't worry about them. But there is amillennialism, and there is historic premillennialism, and there is postmillennialism." And then he said at the bottom, he said, "And then there is dispensational premillennialism." That's us. And by the way, there had never been a pastor in that church that had been around for at least 70 years that wasn't thoroughly, thoroughly dispensational premillennial. But anyway, and then he drew a line, and he said, "You know, any of these three is okay." This is what he said. "But that one down there, that's Looney Tunes." And I called him and said, "Bob, that's no integrity in that for you to say." But anyway, so we sat, and finally I said to him, forgive me for this, is a crazy story, but I said, "Bob, we're good friends, and I'd been in his church a number of times." And I said, I have no authority in your life, but I'm going to use all the influence. I am begging you to make a commitment that for 1 year, you will not, for every hour you read about the Bible, about theology, you will spend an hour in the Bible. And that most of that will be in the Old Testament. Because I told you, what you are saying, you can't get out of the Bible. And if you would read the Old Testament, you would realize this won't work. I just can't overstate it. It's so important. You know what? Let me say one other thing, too. There are many reasons why it's so important to learn the Old Testament. And it shouldn't, I mean, it's so delightful. The best stories in the world, for heaven's sake. And again, I'm preaching to the choir. You've had pastors who cherish the Old Testament and been faithful in that regard. But the primary reason in my mind that it's so desperately important to saturate your mind in the Old Testament is because of what I said last night. And that is that by reason of the finished work of Jesus Christ, by reason of the fact that this blessed, these bottomlessly precious blessings of the new covenant relationship have been provided for us, one of which is intimacy with the Father. It seems to me that along with that blessedness, that access, that intimacy, that level of intimate relationship that you and I enjoy comes with a besetting sin. And that besetting sin or carelessness, frankly, is carelessness about the character of the God who has invited you to enjoy such a relationship. If you have that kind of access, you can begin to forget who this God is with whom you enjoy that relationship. And God has provided one antidote for that carelessness. It is the Old Testament. And it is dangerous enterprise, in my humble estimation, to enjoy the blessings of new covenant relationship without saturating your... Because here's the thing. In the New Testament, you study theology proper, you'll spend all your time in the Old Testament. Because God, wherever you are in the Bible, He expects you to bring with you everything He already said. And it's in the Old Testament that He puts Himself on display, primarily in historical narrative, but then in song and in proposition and so on. And it's in the Old Testament that we are confronted, happily, for those of us who belong to Him, with the bottomless majesty and purity and worthiness of that God. And if you don't saturate your soul spirit with that truth as to who God is, and then you're going to live in this intimate relationship. See what I'm saying to you? It's really imperative to shape our understanding of God and to reshape it day by day by saturating our soul spirits with what God reveals about Himself in the Old Testament. So, how to get off on that? My point is that I'm going to come way back. My point is this, that by reason of whatever sorry set of reason, there is a real carelessness, honest to goodness, in the evangelical world today about this reality is almost universally, at least underappreciated, in many cases, absolutely denied. What reality? This. This is Jesus, the words of Jesus. Salvation is of the Jews. Now, what he meant by that, when he said that to the woman at Sychar, and remember the context was, she said, well, we worship on this mountain and you worship down there. And Jesus said, look, salvation is of the Jews. And I said this to you before. What that means is that before Jesus, the way you would approach God, anybody, anywhere, was through Israel. And so again, I actually talked about this the other night, so I don't have to say too much about it, but I remember I appealed to Ruth, your God will be my God, and thus your people will be my people. And I like to say it this way, that in the Old Testament, Gentiles could be saved, but that would happen only to the degree that they were willing to surrender their Gentileness and identify with Israel. And like I say, it might be that we talk about Naaman and a little bit of dirt he piled on the back of his donkey, you know. So Naaman doesn't move, but he takes some Israeli dirt and takes it home to Syria and so on. But that mentality, and again, I said to you that it's a function of the fact that, you know, whatever Gentile nation you count yourself a citizen of, there is a patron god or a set of gods that you have to worship to be part of that. And you're going to have to abandon that, turn from those idols in order to serve the living and true God. And in so doing, you're going to identify with Israel. That is what is God is. The blessed reality is now Gentiles can be saved as Gentiles. Now, in saying that, I don't mean to suggest that there was anything odious about in the Old Testament about the requirement to embrace the people of Yahweh, because that's the means by which you would approach Yahweh. And so I'm not saying that was odious or cruel, but the fact is that the gospel is the more accessible, and now rather than having to somehow identify with a far-off people, we gather as local churches and so on. So it is clearly a blessedness that the gospel goes to Gentiles as Gentiles. And but again, let's go to Romans 11. Did I go there the other night? I got to talking about this and told myself when I did it, oh, you're going to be sorry when you get to. But in Romans chapter 11, now again, this is Paul. Let me just rehearse it real quickly. This is Paul, in my mind, answering the second of those perceived or possible objections as to the perfect righteousness of God. And in this case, he's answering the question, well, how could a covenant-keeping, righteous God abandon his covenant people, Israel? And the answer is, number one, he was required to do it because he keeps covenant. He had promised to do this, but it's temporary. And Paul addresses this right here where he says, I say then, has God cast away his people? Certainly not. Certainly not. You know, what's the old King James phrase translation there? Remember? What is it? God forbid. I like that, but neither the word God nor the word forbid is there. But it's clearly kind of an expression. God forbid. You know, there's a lot more. It's not a reason. I don't think so. It's for heaven's sakes, don't say that out loud. You know, I mean, that's the spirit. So he says, certainly not, for I am also an Israelite of the seed of Abraham. And he sort of proves it from himself. But we'll have to explain a lot of things. Let me drop down, because then he asks the question again. And he says, I say then, he's coming back to it, has Israel stumbled that they should fall? And the idea, they've stumbled, but does it mean that they're going to fall and never get up again? Again, certainly not. Then he explains, but through their fall, and this is clearly a purpose phrase, in order to provoke them to jealousy, salvation has come to the Gentiles. Now, that's a fairly unambiguous statement. And Paul goes on to say that he is anxious in his own life. He says in verse 13, I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am an apostle of the Gentiles and magnify my ministry, because if by any means I may provoke to jealousy those who are my flesh and save some of them. So right here in my own life, I realize this and I get aggressive about winning Gentiles to the Lord. Because this is the way that God will perhaps draw Jewish people to the Lord, even, and that's, we can make that, we can apply that to ourselves. That there's a website called it's part of chosen people, and it's called nuts. One for Jesus, or anybody know what I'm talking about? I'll figure it out. I go there just on occasion. It has so much really, really powerful material for outreach to Jewish people. But where I spend all my time, to be honest with you, is these testimonies. And they have these testimonies. You won't be able to get up and walk away. You say, oh, one more. And what is it? I think that's it. One for Jesus. Yeah. And But the point is, and it's kind of a strange setting. Remember those weird canvas chairs that were on a piece of metal and just kind of these big shapes they used to have in the 1980s? The guy's sitting in one of those chairs, or a woman and so on. And it's kind of dark, and they have a couple of cameras, and sometimes they do the nose hair thing. You know, I don't understand that, you know, where they get real close and so on. But the point is that they just give their testimony. And they're some of the most powerful testimony you ever heard. Oh, they're so good. Does any of you know the name Andrew Klavan? I don't know. Klavan's kind of a big conservative voice these days. He wrote a book called... now I'm having trouble with that. What's Klavan's book? The Great Good Thing or something like that. But he was a very, you know, he gives his testimony on there. But here's what I'm saying to you. In almost every one, there will be, you know, there would be somebody in the person's life. My sister came to the Lord. We were all so angry with her. And she was so sweet. And I watched her life. And I thought, I got to have what she's got. And one of these after the other. And folks, that's, you know, I will argue, and I think I can make the case, that miracles are always about proving a man's claim to be a divine messenger, and thus the authority and the accuracy of the message. And let's not talk about this, Bookman, but I would argue that in the true bluest sense, and I realize we can talk about God's power and so on, but in the truest sense, miracles are not for today, and you know, in the sense of, I don't want to go there, but I just want to make this point. I think there is one miracle which is on display today, and that is the miracle of a changed life. When God changes, and this is the fruit of the Spirit, when God changes and shapes and flavors a person's life in a way that there's no other explanation but God's grace, that's going to impact all the people in that person's circle. And that's what he's talking about. Now, I go back to it. That what is it that what he's talking about is that the reason, folks, let this sink in for a minute. The reason that God changed the ground rules so dramatically, and for Abraham, for 2,000 years, the way to be saved was to one degree or another, embrace Abraham and his people and his God. And all of a sudden, and it is very sudden, God's going to change that. Now, let me just tell you something. I said this to you before, and there is so much going on in the book of Acts, and we cherish it, obviously. But it seems to me that really what the big event in the book of Acts is God persuading the early, entirely Jewish church that the gospel was to go to Gentiles as Gentiles. It's interesting to trace it. Paul, God brings to himself this young genius, rabid for orthodoxy, named Saul of Tarsus. Saul, after his conversion on the way to Damascus, tarries in Damascus for 3 years. Sometime during those 3 years, he was led to Arabia, wherever that is. He wasn't there for 3 years. He was there for we don't know how long within that space of 3 years, because it was 3 years from when he got saved to when he was led down over the basket at Damascus, you know. So for 3 years, he's in Damascus. For part of that, he goes to Arabia. Now, when you think of Arabia, you're thinking way down Saudi Arabia and so on. I think very possibly just about 30 miles to the east was a huge desert called the Arabian Desert. He got alone with God, and God revealed himself to him in powerful ways. I don't know, we can't be sure about this, but I think very possibly this is what Paul remembers in Corinthians when he says, I know one who was caught up into the third heaven and so on. I think maybe this is the Arabian revelatory experience. Why? Because, and you remember when God appeared to the guy who baptized, Ananias? Yeah, who baptized him? What's his name? Yeah. And says, he is a chosen vessel for me to bear the gospel to the Gentiles. And I think Ananias' jaw would have dropped. And so now God informs Paul that he is the vessel. He, the most unlikely vessel that would seem possible, is totally, totally high, you know, high-bound Jew. is going to be the one. And then, interestingly enough, after 3 years, he does in fact visit Jerusalem. This is recorded in Galatians 1. He is there for only 15 days, but he reports to Peter. It's an interesting, and I'm convinced that he, I think you can build the case that he went to Peter specifically to introduce. Peter is the most important voice, the most important person in the Jewish, the very Jewish early church. And God contrives this interview where Paul, that's not explicit, but the way it's described, so I think the case can be made, that he basically wanted to make sure Peter understood that, and Peter's going to have difficulty with it. But then what happens? Paul is, there's an attempt on his life, and he goes up to his homeland, Tarsus area, Syria and Cilicia, he calls it. And he's there for 10 years. And by his own testimony, the Christian community doesn't know what's going on. They just heard that this one who used to persecute us now preaching the gospel. Remember that? Then, meanwhile, back at the ranch, the gospel has spread up to Antioch. And it's interesting that we're told in Acts that as the gospel spread up to Antioch, north, it's just about 50 miles north of Israel, in Syria, as it spread up to Antioch, the Jews, this is by reason of persecution, so the Jewish believers fled, and they began to share the gospel in Antioch, but Luke says, to none but Jews only. Now, this is somewhere several years in, and the Jewish church, the Jewish Christian community, totally Jewish, they're still insisting that you can't be rightly related to God until you embrace Judaism. And then what happens is that they send Barnabas up. And Barnabas hears about this. He remembers Saul. And so the work is so good there at Antioch that he just goes around the corner of the Mediterranean Sea there to Tarsus and fetches Saul and brings Saul to Antioch. And they minister for a year at Antioch. And then remember that there are those in the teachers in the church at Antioch, and God speaks, I think, through probably a prophetic voice, a New Testament prophet, and says, separate me, Barnabas and Saul, unto the work. And what do? They go out and they begin to evangelize Gentiles. And remember I told you before, I'm not shifting gears as far as it sounds, but remember I mentioned with regard to the way God introduced Trinitarianism. That rather than sending a prophet, he sent Jesus and made him. Well, that's exactly what he does here. Because God knows that this is going to be so incredible. Okay? They're not going to believe it. The Jewish Christian community is not going to be able to. It's going to be with great difficulty that God gets across the message that they're to accept Gentiles as Gentiles. Why is this so difficult? Because all of these years, salvation is of the Jews. And God's turning a huge corner here. And we don't appreciate this. And so now, Paul and Barnabas go out for a year and a half, and they have this marvelous, marvelous ministry. And they begin to see Gentiles come to the Lord, and they don't get circumcised. They're not asked to observe the Jewish feast. They don't have to live Jewishly. And they make they're formed into. This is another thing that's happening here, and forgive me, but I'm so fascinated by the way God introduces the doctrine. This is my next point, the doctrine of the local church. Maybe I'll leave it there, but I won't go back there. But it just kind of materializes on the pages of Scripture. You know, we just kind of. Anybody remember when, I don't know if they're still around, Polaroid cameras first came out? Some of you are old enough, you know. I remember my dad came home from one of those. He had a sales job, and he came home, and he had this Polaroid camera, and we all sit there, you know, and he takes this picture. Come here, come here, come here. And we said, there are demons in there, you know. The picture just kind of materialized in front of me. There it is. That's kind of the way the local church happens. You know, you're just reading the New Testament, and a little more, you know. But God never sits anybody down and says, now let me talk to you about the local church and what it's going to look like. It's just kind of, that's almost entirely the ministry of Paul. But what I'm after is that in the local church, there are Jews and Gentiles. And as I said to you a couple of times in Ephesians 2, Paul makes the point that the angels who watched this happen were staggered all over again with the wisdom of God that he could make Jew and Gentiles. It's not difficult to understand how they could accept Ruth, who surrendered her Gentiles and became Jewish, but how Jew and Gentile, one new body. Now, here's my point. So God is making this point through Paul. What happens then? He goes out on his first journey and has a marvelous, God blesses so remarkably. And folks, you and I, we're saying, yeah, it's such a goodness that people are getting saved. But you got to understand, there's another dynamic here, and it's a very specific dynamic. It's not just people are getting saved, but Gentiles are getting saved. And they're becoming one body in the local church with Jews. Who can think of this? But now, Paul goes back to Antioch, and what happens? Good, faithful, well-taught, well-meaning Jewish Christians come up from Jerusalem and confront Paul. And they say, you can't do this. You can't say that these Gentiles can be accepted without circumcision. And that's what gives rise to the council. So now they go down to Jerusalem and they get... Now, this had begun... Excuse me. Drive you nuts when you get mustache hair in your mouth, girl. But this is... TMI, I know. But... This had actually begun. You remember that Peter, there at Caesarea Philippi, Jesus had said something rather mysterious. You are Peter, and I'm going to give you the keys of the kingdom. Now, the kingdom is yet future. But when a person gets saved today, let me just say, I'm wandering all over the place. And I've said this to you before. But don't get too fixated on heaven, okay? Bless, you know, I'm one of the older guys in the room. I, you know, it's close, but and it beats all the alternatives. Don't get me wrong, but the fact is that our destiny is not heaven. Our destiny is a kingdom, and we're not going to go off to some netherland and float about. And I always say, spend a couple hundred years trying to learn to play the harp, and then don't know exactly what to do with ourselves, you know. But the fact is that we're going to be busy. There's a kingdom coming. So when Peter says, I'm giving you, when Jesus says keys to the kingdom, the point is that hitherto the way to be assured of entrance into that kingdom yet to come was to embrace Yahweh and his people. But he's going to open it up. And later on, Peter is told to go up to Caesarea Maritima and to minister to this man named Cornelius. And you can hear the tumblers start to rattle there when those Gentiles accept the truth and the Spirit God, the Spirit falls upon them and they speak in tongues, just like back there at Pentecost. And the fact is that this has been at some time, but when they gather there in Antioch all those years later, not in Jerusalem, when they come down from Antioch and gather in Jerusalem for this council in Acts 15, you get Peter, you get James, you get all these apostolic voices and so on. And I think most important would be this, folks. We were a year and a half in Galatia, Gentile territory, and we saw thousands of people clearly come to the Lord. And God is in this. And I think Paul would have appealed to the revelation given to him there. And so my point is that what's going on in the book of Acts is that God is contriving with divine cleverness and perseverance to introduce this stunning reality. The Gentiles are to be accepted as Gentiles. And why? Because this is God's means of evoking jealousy. I'm going to say it again. This is not an aberration. It's not a parenthesis. It's not an afterthought. This is a sublimely clever, resourceful strategy by which God is going to accomplish his covenant of bringing a generation of Jewish people to himself. And one of the strategies is sitting right here in this room. That's what God is doing. Does that make sense to you? We live out, we enjoy, we wallow in, we celebrate the goodness of God and specifically sins once and for all forgiven and this intimate spirit relationship to the Father and individual Jews in this day as well as Gentiles, to be sure. But I think corporately, as they recall that, it's going to be part of what God uses to accomplish their redemption. All right. Well, I'll leave it alone. Finally, let's take a break. Let's take a 10-minute break and be back about 9:15, just one more, and then we'll pull it together and pretend we... So, let's take a break.